I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's July 12th, and we have a lot to talk about. As a rule, and for so many reasons, children are truly remarkable. For better or worse, they have the ability to soak up everything around them. They rarely miss much, and that can include a parent who's living with MS. The truth is, when it comes to kids, efforts at covering up MS symptoms probably aren't as successful as you may think they are. And because kids don't have an understanding of neurological conditions, well, they use their imaginations to fill in the blanks. And that can very quickly take them down a rabbit hole that's far scarier than the reality of living with MS. So when do you talk with your kids about MS? And what do you say? Joining me to answer those questions and to fill us in on how children process their parents' MS is a licensed social worker and behavioral specialist, Erin Martin. But before we get to my conversation with Erin, there are a few other things that you should know about. Smoking isn't good for anyone, and a number of studies have identified smoking as a risk factor for developing MS. I've had some people tell me that once they've been diagnosed with MS, they're no longer too concerned about risk factors because, well, that ship has already sailed. And I've even heard other people say that since they're living with MS, they're less worried about the effects of smoking. Well, new evidence suggests that if you're living with MS and you're still smoking, you may want to reconsider things. A research team in Norway followed 84 people living with relapsing-remitting MS. The team identified 48 of the study participants as regular smokers and 36 of the participants as non-smokers. After 10 years, the mean age of all the study participants was about 49. And after taking into account the study participants' age, sex, cardiovascular risk factors, level of disability, and time from diagnosis, an analysis of MRI data showed that compared to the non-smokers, the smokers had experienced significantly more brain atrophy, and they had a higher number of brain lesions. As a group, the smokers had worse walking ability as measured by the timed 25-foot walk test, and the smokers had greater declines in cognitive attention. So the evidence from this study makes a pretty strong case that smoking is not only a risk factor for developing MS, but it also may have a negative long-term effect on MS progression. If the risk of developing cancer isn't enough of a motivator, this study provides some compelling evidence-based reasons for anyone living with MS to treat themselves to a better long-term quality of life by putting down that cigarette and maybe chewing a stick of gum instead. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. I hope that by now, everyone who's listening to this podcast has received their COVID-19 vaccinations and boosters. If you're immunocompromised and you received either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, the National MS Society's guidance is that you should receive a total of 5 doses of those vaccines, 2 vaccination doses, and then 3 boosters. And you can find a link to the Society's detailed COVID-19 vaccination guidance in today's show notes. But one of the interesting and challenging aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic is that there wasn't this great body of knowledge about what to do or how to treat COVID-19 before it had spread over most of the world. That means that scientists have been learning about this virus in real time. And newly published results of a study from Italy are adding to this body of evidence-based knowledge that continues to grow. Now, in this study, the research team analyzed data from 19,641 people living with MS who were being followed by 27 different Italian MS centers between March and December of 2021. The patient's mean age was just over 42, 62% were women, and 84.7% had relapsing remitting MS. All of the study participants had either received two or three doses of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, or they had received one dose of the vaccine and then had been diagnosed with COVID-19. Now, all of this happened before the Omicron variant was upon us, so things may be quite different today, but the evidence from this study still makes an important point. Within about 8 months of their last vaccine dose, 137 of the more than 19,000 study participants experienced breakthrough COVID-19 infections. And when they looked at which disease-modifying therapies all of the study participants were on, the rate of breakthrough infection was more than three times higher among those patients who were treated with Ocrevus, and it was 2.7 times higher among those patients treated with Gilenya. Now, among those 137 study participants who experienced a breakthrough infection, 69.3% had mild to moderate symptoms that didn't require any further treatment. 10 patients required hospitalization, one patient was admitted to the intensive care unit, and there were no deaths. So the results of this study confirmed that the risk of experiencing a breakthrough COVID-19 infection, even after being fully vaccinated, appears to be higher for people on Ocrevus or Gilenya. But as they say on late-night television, wait, there's more, and it's good news if you're on Ocrevus. Two researchers in Merrillville, Indiana, conducted a small study at the Methodist hospitals. They recruited 18 people living with relapsing remitting MS. 17 of them were on Ocrevus and one was on Kesimpta. All 18 participants had been vaccinated against COVID-19, and 17 of them had received a third booster dose. Now, after vaccination, 12 of these 18 participants had an undetectable COVID antibody level, and the other 6 participants had an extremely low level of COVID antibodies. Then all 18 study participants received a dose of Evusheld, which has been authorized for use by the FDA for anyone who is immunocompromised due to a health condition or due to immune-suppressing medications. And 2 weeks after receiving Evusheld, all 18 study participants showed the highest level of antibody protection that could be measured. Now, I'll remind you that this is one small study, but I'll also remind you that the National MS Society has recommended that you consult with your doctor to determine whether Evusheld makes sense for you. This small study provides a small piece of evidence that those of you on Ocrevus or any B-cell depleting therapy may want to follow up on. And if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find the link in today's show notes. Late last month, the International Progressive MS Alliance hosted an excellent webinar entitled Solving the Mystery of Progression, the Key to New Treatments for Progressive MS. This webinar featured a panel of international MS experts discussing findings and insights that not only inspire hope, but demonstrate real progress in ending progressive MS. I want to give you a heads up that if you missed that webinar, you'll find a link to the video replay in today's show notes. Currently, there seems to be a tremendous amount of scientific interest in myelin repair. Every week, it seems like we're talking about one more study that's focused on it. And all of that activity begs the question, how will we know that myelin repair or remyelination has occurred? In other words, how will scientists measure myelin repair? Well, an international team of experts has suggested that an MRI technique called quantitative susceptibility mapping, or QSM, can be used to accurately identify remyelinated brain lesions in people living with MS. As you already know, multiple sclerosis is a demyelinating disease. The myelin sheath that surrounds nerve fibers in the central nervous system is progressively damaged. That leads to what you can think of as faulty communications in our central nervous system, and that damage leads to MS symptoms and disability. Myelin repair means restoring the physical function that's been lost to MS. And remyelinated lesions are those lesions in the myelin sheath that have been repaired. So without taking too deep of a dive, QSM is an MRI technique that's sensitive to iron accumulation and myelin content in the brain. And to determine whether this technique could be used to identify various types of MS lesions, including lesions representing myelin repair, an international team of scientists analyzed MRI data for just over 1,600 lesions in 115 people living with MS. 76 were living with active relapsing remitting MS, and 39 were living with inactive progressive MS. The scientists also analyzed MRI data from 76 people without MS. And the team measured myelin content, myelin density, and nerve fiber content. A detailed analysis of the images and measurements provided evidence that QSM could effectively distinguish chronic MS lesions in a clinical setting. Importantly, the study concluded that QSM could provide highly sensitive and specific biomarkers of completed remyelination. And so now, an evidence-based method of measuring myelin repair appears to be within reach. If you'd like to review the details of this work, you'll find the link in today's show notes. Estrogens are a group of female hormones that have been shown to have neuroprotective properties. Estriol is an estrogen produced during a woman's pregnancy, and it's been well documented that during pregnancy, MS disease activity is dramatically reduced. So a research team at UCLA analyzed blood samples that were taken during a 2-year phase 2 clinical trial involving 158 women with relapsing remitting MS. And their analysis showed that a combination of estriol and copaxone, one of the oldest MS disease modifying medications, significantly reduced the levels of neurofilament light chain in the blood. And this reduction in neurofilament light chain levels was associated with reduced brain lesion volume. As a refresher, neurofilament light chain is a protein that's released when nerve damage occurs in the central nervous system. And as we've discussed in previous podcast episodes, there's considerable scientific interest in determining whether neurofilament light chain levels can serve as a biomarker for MS progression before MS symptoms are even identified. This study demonstrated that women who were not pregnant were able to experience that same neuroprotection by the combination of estriol and copaxone, while it underscored the validity of neurofilament light chain as a reliable biomarker in MS. I'm hopeful that we'll see further exploration of the role of estriol in mitigating MS symptoms and disease activity. And if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Children see everything, even and maybe especially the things we adults try to hide. But they don't always understand everything they see. And when that happens, they just let their imaginations fill in the blanks. And those imaginations can come up with some pretty frightening scenarios. That's why if you're living with MS, it's important to talk to your children about it. And in a moment, my guest Erin Martin will join us to talk about talking about MS with your child. MS doesn't just affect individuals. It affects families. And children in particular can have a hard time understanding what it means when a parent has MS and observing the challenges that parent may experience. Join me to share some tips and insights on how parents can speak to their children about MS is Erin Martin, a licensed social worker and director of engagement and programming at Withall, Erin is also a youth camp counselor and behavioral specialist, and she recently launched Caregiver Collaborative, an organization that supports non-traditional and underrepresented caregivers with a focus on young people. Welcome to the podcast, Erin.
Thank you for having me.
Whether we grown-ups like to acknowledge it or not, children see everything. And when they don't have any information to explain the changes they see and sense going on around them, they use their imaginations to fill in the blanks. And I think, as we all learn, the things they imagine are far worse than reality. I'm pretty sure that last part is true for adults as well. But tell me, why is it important for parents to talk to their children about MS?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. When we don't talk to kids about what's going on around them, they start to make up their own story and they fill in the blanks with information. Oftentimes it's a lot scarier or a lot worse than it really is. This is particularly true for young kids. I think they see things happening around them and they start to make those connections to their own life. And they might start to think like, gosh, should I cause my parent to have MS? Are these symptoms my fault? And so I think the best thing we can do is really provide kids accurate and age-appropriate information that will really help to clear up that confusion and really help reassure them. And we can more easily help them alleviate those feelings that they might have of guilt or shame or confusion. And I know that this can be really scary and intimidating for adults to talk to kids about this, but I think it's really important to have those conversations early and often as they get older. And with a little practice, we can feel less scared and more confident in those conversations, and kids will feel more informed and more comfortable coming to you when they're feeling scared or worried or overwhelmed.
You just mentioned that we should be sharing accurate and age-appropriate information with children. So what's the right age to begin having these conversations with your child? How old should your child be?
I think that there is no right age. I think as soon as we know, and we've had some time as adults to process that information ourselves, we can start sharing information with kids really at, you know, as young, as soon as they're kind of ready to talk and can be having conversations with us. But I think the amount of information and the depth of information that we provide kids will really vary based on their age and their maturity level and kind of their readiness to handle that information. But even really young kids, I was about 3 when my dad was diagnosed, and my parents started kind of dripping information to us pretty much right away. And so I think you can really start young, helping kids to develop that kind of basic understanding of what's going on.
Kids tend to have 2 very common worries. Is mommy or daddy going to die? And can I catch this, or will I inherit what they have? How should parents address those kinds of questions?
Yeah, I think, you know, it can be really heartbreaking and really tough to hear kids ask these questions. And I think that's why it's super important to address them right away when they do come up, or even perhaps before they come up for kids. And so, you know, when it comes to the question of can I get MS, I think it's really important to reiterate with young kids, especially that while we don't know what causes MS, we do know that it can't be inherited. And we also know that you can't catch it like you can catch a cold or the flu, and really reassuring them that, you know, it's not their fault and it's not something that they need to be overly concerned about. But I think then, you know, similarly sharing some of the exciting things that are going on, talking about the great treatments that are available, talking about the different medications or tools that people can use to manage their symptoms, the research that's going on that can help, that are helping us get closer and closer to understanding what MS is and what a cure is every day, is going to be really helpful for kids. When we're talking about, you know, kids start asking, you know, can you die from this? I think it's super important to emphasize very early that MS is not a fatal diagnosis, and really reassuring kids in that way that, you know, it might be tough and there's a lot of symptoms that you might experience that might be scary, that might put us at risk of injury or of illness, but we're taking the precautions necessary as a family. And that's why it's really important that we're paying attention to what's going on with our symptoms and how our bodies feel, so that we can really address that early and really help protect ourselves. But continuing to tell kids, like, it's not a fatal diagnosis. Mom's not going to die from having MS. And we're doing what we can to help protect her.
You know, MS can be very tricky to talk about, even with an adult. There might be physical disabilities that are visible. There are often symptoms that are invisible. And some of those invisible symptoms, like fatigue, for instance, well, they can be very difficult for a child to even understand. So what's a good way to explain MS to a child?
It can be really challenging. I think that the MS Society has some really great resources that families can use. But one that I know in my family that was used when I was younger was the kind of analogy of an electrical cord. And so really, you know, explaining to kids what that protective coating on an electrical cord is there to help make sure that the signal gets from the outlet to our computer, to our tablet, to all the things that we use every day. And when that cord protection gets damaged, that signal might get lost completely, or it might, you know, come through and make the image blurry, or some of these other things, the sound might come across weird. And that's really similar to what's happening in our bodies when we have MS. And so, you know, we can help kids understand in that way. But just remembering whatever information we do decide to provide for kids, again, it should be accurate, it should be age appropriate, and we can take their lead. So as kids start to ask more questions, we can provide more information, we can direct them to some new resources and start to bring that information in for kids. When talking about, you know, those symptoms, I think relating symptoms back to things kids might already understand. So you mentioned fatigue, like you could talk to them about like, have you ever been like really, really, really tired? Like you've stayed up way too late and you just had a rough day the next day. It's like sort of like that, but you know, all the time or frequently anyways. Or if we're talking about vision changes, you might literally demonstrate it. Rub some soap on some glasses, put them on your kid. And that might be a good way to kind of say like, it sort of looks like this to me. So really helping kids to experience that a little bit and then talk about what are some different things that we can do to alleviate those symptoms or to adapt and be able to really thrive in our lives regardless.
What's the best way to address the fact that sometimes mom or dad seems fine and other times they struggle? How do you talk about the relapsing and remitting aspects of MS?
Yeah, I know explaining the idea of relapses or exacerbations can be like kind of tough, but I think, again, going back to the example of the electrical cord, you might even like show an example of, we might put some tape on the electrical cord and that's kind of a temporary fix. So that might be like medication or something like that we're taking. And eventually a temporary fix might stop working or another part of the cord might get frayed and that interrupts the signal in a different way. And so I think we can always kind of revert back to whatever these examples are and try and help kids visualize like, okay, I sort of get that. And then I think having kind of open conversations about, you know, sometimes my symptoms get worse when I'm fatigued or when I'm in extreme heat or when I'm really stressed out. And so that's why it's really important that I'm well rested or I'm, you know, eating right or taking care of my body in these different ways can really help kids to understand why we're doing some of the things we're doing to try and have some sense of control over a seemingly unpredictable disease.
What's the best way to normalize physical disability for children? If one parent has visible gait issues or uses a mobility aid, kids can feel embarrassed being out in public with them. What's the best way to address that?
Yeah, I think having open conversations with kids is really normal for them to feel like, you know, my friend's parents don't have to go through this, so why should I have to go through it? But really normalizing that for kids and having conversations early and often about why they're using those things. And I think, you know, it can be really tough for kids to have that conversation and for them to feel like they have little control over that information, but inviting them to talk to you about that, to share their feelings with you. And then perhaps using that opportunity to encourage them, you know, hey, maybe this is a chance for us to educate our friends or our family and to have these conversations. So if there are folks that they feel comfortable talking to about these things, it can really be helpful for them to open up and know that there's someone out there who can relate to them or at least understand what's going on in a different way than perhaps kind of everyone else might be relating to them.
You know, kids are still only kids, and there will be times when a child feels sad and frustrated when one of their parents may not be able to do all the things that they see their friend's parents able to do. What should that conversation be like?
I totally understand this. As a kid, this was something, I was an athlete. My dad couldn't make it to all of my activities. And I know that it can be really, really sad. It can be frustrating. And so I think it's important to have a conversation kind of early about this and to come up with a plan together. So if a young person's feeling this way, I would always encourage them, hey, you know, talk to your parents about this. If you're a parent and you're noticing like, I'm just not making it to everything, open the door to have that conversation and then come up with a plan together. So I think the really great thing that's come out of especially the last few years is the opportunity that we can make a lot of really creative adaptations. So can we live stream things? Can we record them to share later and watch them back together as a family, finding, you know, creative ways? Are there adaptive equipment that we can use to try to get out to some of these things or different ways that we could be doing, still trying to show up when we can, when we're feeling well? And then I think, you know, equally as important is, you know, you're not going to make it to everything. That's okay. find activities that you can enjoy together. So maybe that's an indoor activity or an activity where everyone has to sit, puzzles, games, movies, whatever that looks like for you, will be really important to help kids feel like, okay, they can't always make it to my activity, but I know Tuesday nights are puzzle night and that's always going to be consistent. We're always going to make that happen.
I know that not everyone discloses their MS outside the family. How do parents talk to their child about keeping the secret?
I think asking kids to keep secrets can be really hard. And I know each family really does need to take some time to address this in their within their own family. There's a lot of good reasons why people might not share or disclose that they have MS with certain groups of people. But asking kids to keep secrets can be hard. So instead, I always encourage folks to help kids understand the word privacy instead of secret, right? So that, for example, talking with kids about a time maybe they did something embarrassing and they don't want all their classmates to know about it, and that's information we're going to keep private. This is sort of the same thing, something that we're going to keep with certain people and we're not really going to talk about it in front of certain groups, and helping them understand the difference of who those folks are and maybe a little bit about why. And I think, too, it's important to let kids know that, you know, if they slip up and they share it with someone that perhaps you wish they wouldn't have, that, like, you're not going to be mad at them. They're not in trouble. It's just something that we would prefer that we didn't share. And then kind of, again, come back to explaining to them, like, what privacy means and why we might want to keep these things to ourselves.
When a parent is living with MS, kids sometimes end up taking on extra chores around the house. But those added responsibilities can sometimes grow to the point of impacting that child's emotional well-being. How can parents be cognizant of when a child's caregiving responsibilities begin to be too much? And maybe more importantly, what can parents do to avoid things reaching that point?
Yeah, I'm very familiar. This is something that was certainly true in my house, taking on lots of extra chores. And I always caution parents, and I know it's really hard and can be challenging to know how much you can put on your kid's plate, but their brains are developing. They're literally, like, growing, and those opportunities that they have to participate in different activities or have a social life of their own are really, really important to their growth and development. And so when we start asking kids to take on too many other tasks, it can really get in the way of those things, and it can interfere with that. And, you know, kids are with parents who have MS or any other chronic illness are already asked to grow up so much more quickly than their peers around them. And so being really careful about how much we're putting on their plates. And so I think a couple of things, you know, if you're in a position to do so, I think I always encourage families to reach out and find some outside help. What that looks like might be asking friends and family or neighbors to pitch in, but you might also be in a position where you can hire someone to come in and help, or you can have a church group or community organization come in and do some of those things. And so that's not to say I'm suggesting that you shouldn't ask your kids to do anything. Of course, you know, sometimes it's necessary to ask kids to be pitching in, but really keeping an eye on when they start to feel overwhelmed, or they're experiencing symptoms of burnout or ongoing stress, or when they're missing a lot of activities, that can be a really good time for us to be, like, taking a second look at what that schedule looks like for our kid, and reassessing and figuring out if there's a better balance we can find. And I know that that can be really tough, but I think the trade-off of being able to figure out how to help, have some other folks come in and help us, it will pay off in the end when our young people feel more balanced, they feel healthier, they feel more fulfilled, they feel more connected to the family. And I think that that's really, really important.
Erin Martin, thank you for sharing a lot of important information about a subject that every family affected by MS faces, but it's a subject that doesn't get talked about nearly enough. So thanks for talking about it with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/254. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. and it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.